but had not I been the same once? I was returning to the fire when I stepped on the fourth feather. As I stooped to pick it up, I saw the fifth one glinting in the sunlight, not a dozen paces away. The fifth one shone with extraordinary colours, dazzling to the eyes, but when I reached it, I decided it had been a trick of the sunlight and damp, for it was as flat and grey as its brethren. The prince was not by the fire when I returned, though he had built up the fire before he left. I set the two feathers with the three I had found the night before. I glanced about for the lad and saw him walking back towards me. He had evidently visited the stream, for his face was damp and his hair washed back from his brow. When he reached the fire, he stood over me for a time, watching me as I killed the crab and wrapped it and the mussels in the flat fronds of seaweed. With a stick I nudged some of the burning wood aside, and then gingerly placed the packet on the bared coals. It sizzled. He watched me pushing other coals up around it. When he spoke, his voice was even, as if he commented on the weather. "I've a message for you. If you do not bring me back before sunset, they will kill them both, the man and the wolf." I did not even betray that I had heard his words. I kept my eyes on the food, edging the coals closer to it. When I finally spoke, my words were just as cold. "Perhaps if they do not free the man and the wolf before noon, I will kill you." I lifted my face to look into his and showed him my assassin's eyes. He took a step back. "But I am the prince!" he cried. An instant later I saw how he despised those words, but he could not call them back. They hung quivering in the air between us. "That would only matter if you acted like a prince," I observed callously. "But you don't. You're a tool, and you don't even know it. Worse, you're a tool used against not just your mother, but the whole of the six duchies." I looked aside from him as I spoke the words I must. "You don't even know that the woman you worship doesn't exist. Not as a woman, at any rate. She's dead, Prince Dutiful. But when she died, instead of letting go, she pushed into her cat's mind to live there. She rides the cat, a shameful thing for any old blood one to do. And she has used the cat to lure you in and deceive you with words of love. I do not know what she intends in the end, but it will not be good for any of you. And it will cost my friends' lives." I should have known that she was with him. I should have known that that was the one thing that she would not permit me to tell him. He hissed like a cat from his open mouth as he sprang, and the tiny sound gave me an instant of warning. I leaned to one side as he threw himself at me. I turned to his passage, caught him by the back of his shirt, and jerked him back towards me. I pinioned him in a hug. He threw his head back in an effort to smash my face, but only got the side of my jaw. I had long been wise to that trick, and it was one of my own favourites. It was not much of a fight as fights go. He was at that lanky stage of his growth when bones and muscles do not yet match one another, and he fought with the heedless frenzy of youth. I had long been comfortable in my body, and I had a man's weight and years of experience to back it. With his arms tightly pinioned, he could do little more than toss his head about and kick at me with his feet. I recognized abruptly that no one had ever grappled with him this way. Of course, a prince would be trained with a blade, not with fists, nor had he had brothers or a father for rough play. He did not know what to make of being manhandled in this way. He repelled at me, the wit equivalent of a mental shove. As Burrick had so long ago with me, I deflected it back at him. I felt his shock at that. In the next moment he redoubled his struggle. I felt the fury that coursed through him. It was like fighting myself, and I knew he set no limits as to what he would do in an attempt to injure me. His mindless savagery was limited only by his inexperience. He tried to fling us both to the ground, but I had his balance too well. His efforts to wriggle out of my embrace only made me tighten my grip. His face was bright red before his head suddenly drooped. For a moment, he hung limp and gasping in my arms. Then he rasped in a sullen voice, "Enough! You win!" I let go, expecting him to drop to the sand. Instead, he spun my knife in his hand and thrust it into my belly. At least that was his intent. The buckle of my sword belt deflected it. The blade skidded across the leather of the belt, and then plunged past me, rapping in my shirt as it went. The blade, so near my flesh, woke my anger. I caught his wrist, snapped it sharply back, and the knife went flying. A blow from my fist to the side of his neck hammered him to his knees. He yowled in fury as he fell, and the sound stood my hair on end. The glaring glance he turned on me was not the prince's, but some awful combination of cat, boy, and a woman who would master them both. Her will was the one that brought him up off his knees and springing towards me. I tried to catch his charge and control him, but he fought like a mad thing, clawing and spitting and ripping at my hair. I hit him hard in the centre of his chest, a blow that should have at least slowed him, but he came back at me, his fury doubled. I knew then that she had full control of him, and that she would care nothing about pain I dealt him. I'd have to damage him if I wanted to stop him, and even at that moment I could not bring myself to do that. So I flung myself to meet his charge, wrapped him in my arms, and used my weight to bear him down. We came down very near the fire, but I was on top and resolved to stay there. Our faces were inches apart as I made good my hold on him. He twisted his head about wildly and tried to strike me in the face with his brow. The eyes that met mine were not the prince's. She spat up at me and cursed me. I lifted him and slammed him back against the earth. I saw his head bounce off the ground. He should have been near stunned, but he darted his mouth at me as if to bite me. I felt a surge of fury that started somewhere so deep it was outside me. "Dutiful!" I roared. "Stop fighting me!" He went limp in my arms. The woman cat glared at me furiously. But slowly she faded from his eyes. Prince Dutiful goggled up at me in terror. Then even that faded from his eyes. He stared like a dead man. Blood outlined his teeth. It was his own, leaking from his nose and over his mouth. He lay very still. I felt sickened. I peeled myself away from him and stood slowly, chest heaving. "Ada and El, mercy," I prayed, as I seldom did. But the gods were not interested in undoing what I had done. I knew what I had done. I had done it before, coldly and deliberately. I had used the skill to forcefully imprint on my uncle, Prince Regal, that he would suddenly become adamantly loyal to Queen Katrikan and the child she carried. I had intended that skill imprint to be permanent, and it had been, though Prince Regal's untimely death but a few months later had prevented me from ever knowing how long such an imposed command would remain in force. This time, I had acted in anger, with no thought beyond the moment. The furious command I had given him had printed itself onto his mind with the full strength of my skill behind it. He had not decided to stop fighting me. Part of him doubtless wished to kill me still. His baffled look told me that he had no comprehension of what I had done to him. Neither did I, really. "Can you get up?" I asked him guardedly.
"Can I get up?"
He echoed my words eerily. His diction was blurred. His eyes rolled about as he seemed to seek an answer in himself, then his gaze came back to me. "You can get up," I ventured, fearfully. And at my words he could. He came to his feet unsteadily, reeling as if I had knocked him cold. The force of my command seemed to have driven the woman's control away, yet to have supplanted that with my own will over him was no victory for me. He stood, shoulders slightly hunched, as if investigating a pain in himself. After a time, he lifted his eyes to look at me.
"I hate you," he told me, in a voice divested of rancor.
"That's understandable," I heard myself reply. Sometimes I shared that sentiment. I couldn't look at him. I found my knife on the sand and returned it to its sheath. The prince lurched around the fire, then sat down on the opposite side. I watched him surreptitiously. He wiped his hand across his mouth and then looked at his bloody palm. Mouth slightly ajar, he ran his tongue past his teeth. I feared he would spit some out, but he did not. He made no complaint at all. Instead, he looked like a man trying desperately to recall something. Humiliated and confused, he stared at the fire. I wondered what he pondered. For a time I sat, feeling all the new little pains he had given me. Many of them were not physical. I doubted they equaled what I had done to him. I could think of nothing to say to him, so I poked at the food in the fire. The seaweed I'd wrapped it in had shrunken and dried in the heat and was beginning to char. I poked the packet out from the coals. Inside, the muscles had opened and the crab's flesh had gone from opaque to white. Close enough to cooked to satisfy me, I decided. "There's food here," I announced. "I'm not hungry," the prince replied. Voice and eyes were distant. "Eat it anyway while there's food to eat," my words came out as a callous command.
Whether it was my skill hold upon him, or his own common sense, I couldn't tell, but after I had taken my share of the food from the seaweed packet, he came cautiously around the fire to claim his share. In some ways, he reminded me of Night Eyes when he had first come to me. The cub had been wary and defiant, yet pragmatic enough to realize he had to depend on me to provide for him. Perhaps the prince knew that without me, he had no hopes of returning easily to Buck. Or perhaps my skill command had burned so deep that even a suggestion from me must be obeyed. The silence lasted as long as the food did, and a bit longer. I broke it. "I looked at the stars last night." The prince nodded. After a time, "We're a long way from home," he admitted, grudgingly. "We may face a long journey home with few resources. Do you know how to live off the land at all?" Again, a silence followed my words. He did not want to speak to me, but I had knowledge he desperately needed. His question came grudgingly. "What about the way we came here? Can't we go back that way?" A frown divided his brows as he asked, "How did you learn to do that magic? Is it the skill?" I broke a little piece of the truth off and gave it to him. "King Verity taught me to skill, a long time ago." Before he could ask another question, I announced, "I'm going to walk down the beach and climb up those cliffs. It could be there's a town nearby." If I had to leave the boy here alone, I'd do my best to leave him in a safe place. And if the skill pillar did not emerge from the water, then I'd best prepare for a long walk home. My will was iron in that regard. I'd return to Buck if I had to crawl there. And once there, I'd hunt down every one of those piebalds and kill them slowly. The promise gave purpose to my motions. I began to pull on my socks and boots. The feathers still lay on the sand. A flick of my fingers slid them up my sleeve. I'd secure them better later. I did not wish to discuss them with the prince. Dutiful made no reply to my words, but when I stood up and walked away from the fire, he followed me. I stopped at the freshwater stream to wash my hands and face and to drink as well. The prince watched me, and when I was finished, he walked upstream to drink himself. While he was occupied, a strip from my shirt secured the feathers to my forearm. By the time he looked up from washing the blood from his face, my sleeve once more concealed them. Together we walked on. The silence felt like a heavy thing we carried between us. I could feel him mulling over what I had told him about the woman. I wanted to lecture him, to batter him with words until he understood exactly what the woman was trying to do. I wanted to ask if she was still in his mind with him. Instead, I bit my tongue and held back my words. He wasn't stupid, I told myself. I'd told him the truth. Now I had to let him work out what it meant to him. We kept walking. To my relief, we found no more feathers on the sand. We found little of anything useful, though the beach seemed to have more than its share of flotsam. There were bits of rotting rope and worm-bored lengths of ship timbers. The remains of a deadeye lay not far from a thole. As we walked, the black cliff gradually loomed larger until it towered above us and promised a good vantage of the land around it. As we drew closer, I saw that its face was pocked with holes. In a sand cliff, I would have thought them swallows' nests, but not in black stone. The holes seemed too regular and too evenly spaced to be the work of natural forces. The sun striking them seemed to wake glints in some of them. Curiosity beckoned me. The reality was stranger than anything I could have imagined. When we reached the foot of the cliff, the holes were revealed as alcoves of graduated sizes. Not all, but many of them held an object. Wordless with wonder, the prince and I strolled along looking at the lowest levels of alcoves. The variety of objects put me in mind of some mad king's treasure hoard. One held a jeweled goblet, the next a porcelain cup of amazing delicacy. In a large alcove was something that looked like a wooden helmet for a horse, save that a horse's eyes are set on the sides of its head, not the front. A net of gold chain, studded with tiny blue gems, had been draped over a stone about the size of a woman's head. A tiny box of gleaming wood with images of flowers on it, a lamp carved from some lustrous green stone. A sheet of metal with odd characters graven into it, a delicate stone flower in a vase. Treasure after treasure after treasure were displayed there. Wonder wrapped me. Who would so display such wealth on an isolated cliff where the wind and waves could batter it? Each item shone as a cherished gem. No tarnish marred the metal. No coating of salt dimmed the wood. To whom did all this belong, and how and why was it here? I looked behind me down the beach, but saw no sign of any inhabitants. No footprints save our own marred the sand. All these marvels were left unguarded. Tempted beyond control, I reached a finger to touch the flower in the vase, only to encounter resistance. It was as if a soft glass covered the opening of the alcove. Foolishly curious, I pressed my hand against the pliable surface. The harder I pressed, the more unyielding the invisible barrier became. I managed to touch one finger to the flower. It moved, and a delicate chiming from its petals just reached my ears. Yet it would have taken a stronger man than I to press a hand in deep enough to grasp that flower. I drew my hand back, and as my flesh left the alcove, my fingers tingled unpleasantly. It reminded me of brushing a nettle, save that it did not last as long. The prince had watched me. "Thief," he observed quietly. I felt like a child caught in some reckless act. I did not intend to take it, but I wished to touch it. "Certainly," he observed sarcastically. "Have it as you will," I replied. I turned my eyes from the distraction of the treasures and looked up the cliff. I realized then that one series of vertical holes was a ladder rather than a succession of alcoves. I said not a word to the prince as I approached them. Studying them, I decided they had been cut for a man taller than myself, but that I could probably manage. Dutiful watched me curiously, but I decided he deserved no explanation. I began my climb. Each handhold was a bit of a stretch for me, and placing my feet demanded that I lift each foot uncomfortably high. I was about a third of the way up the cliff before I realized just how much work the whole climb was going to be. The new bruises the prince had given me throbbed dully. If I'd been myself, I probably would have backed down. I kept climbing, though the old injury in my back began to shriek in protest each time I reached for the next handhold. By the time I reached the top, my shirt was stuck to my back with sweat. I hauled myself over the lip of the cliff on my belly, and then lay still for a moment or two, catching my breath. The wind was freer here, and colder. I stood up slowly and surveyed my surroundings. Lots of water. The shores beyond the point I stood on were rocky and abrupt, no beaches. Behind me I saw forest. Beyond the tableland that fronted our beach was more forest. We were either on an island or a peninsula. I saw no sign of human habitation, no ships on the sea, not even a tendril of smoke rising anywhere. If we had to leave our beach on foot, we'd have to go through the forest. The thought sent a surge of unease through me. After a time I became aware of a thin sound. I walked to the cliff's edge and looked down. Prince Dutiful looked up at me and shouted a question, but the inflection of his words were all that reached my ears. I made a vague hand motion at him, feeling annoyed. If he wanted so badly to know what I saw, let him climb up here himself. My mind was busy with other concerns. Someone had made those alcoves and gathered those treasures. I should see some sign of human occupation somewhere. Logic demanded it. At last I discovered what might be a footpath far down the beach. It led through the tableland and towards the forest. It did not look well used. It might be no more than a game trail, I thought, but I fixed it in my mind in case we had to resort to it. Then I looked out over the retreating water, searching for anything that might indicate worked stone. Nothing was exposed yet, but one area looked promising. As each wave fell back, I had glimpses of what might be several large black stones with straight edges. They were still under a shallow layer of water. I hoped it was not a geological quirk. There was a tangle of driftwood on the beach, with a seaweed-festooned branch that pointed towards the rocks. I noted it as a guide. I wasn't sure the tide would bear the rocks completely, but when it reached its full ebb, I intended to investigate them as much as I could. Finally, with a sigh, I lay down on my belly, scrabbled my legs over the edge, and felt for the first foothold. The climb down was even more unpleasant than the journey up, for I had to grope blindly for each step as I descended. By the time I reached the ground, my legs had a tremor of weariness in them. I skipped the last two steps, dropping to the sand and nearly falling to my knees. "Well, what did you see?" the prince demanded. I let him wait while I caught my breath. "Water, rocks, trees. No town? No road?" "No." "So what are we going to do?" He sounded annoyed, as if it were all my fault. I knew what I would do. I was going back through the skill pillar, even if I had to dive to find it. But what I said to him was, "What I tell you, she knows. Isn't that true?" That stole all his words from him. He stood for a time, just staring at me. When I set off down the beach, he followed me, unaware of how much authority he had ceded to me. The day was not warm, but hiking on sand demands more effort than walking on solid ground. I was tired from my climb and preoccupied with my own worries, so I made no effort at conversation. It was Dutiful who broke the silence. "You said she was dead," he abruptly accused me. "That's impossible. If she is dead, how does she speak to me?" I took a breath to speak, sighed it out after a moment, and then took another. "When you are witted, you bond to an animal. It's more than sharing thoughts, it's sharing being. After a time, you can see through the animal's eyes. Experience its life as it does, perceive the world as the animal does. It isn't just, 'I know all that. I am piebald, you know.'" He gave a snort of contempt for my words. I don't think an interruption has ever irritated me more. "Old blood," I corrected him sharply. "Tell me you're piebald again, and I'll have to beat it out of you. I've no respect for what they do with their magic. Now, how long have you known that you're witted?" I demanded suddenly.
Why?
I saw him struggle to push his mind past my threat. I'd meant it, and he knew it. He took a breath.
"For about 5 months. Since the cat was given to me, almost as soon as her leash was given over to me, I felt..."
"You felt a trap closing on you. One you've been too stupid to perceive. The cat was given to you because others knew you were witted before you knew it yourself. So you've shown signs of it without being aware that you were doing so. Someone noticed, someone decided to use you. So they presented you with an animal to bond with. That's not how it's supposed to be, you know. Witted parents don't just hand their child an animal and say, 'Here, this is your partner for as long as you both live.' No. Usually the child is well schooled in the wit and its consequences before it bonds. Usually the child makes a quest of some sort, seeking a like-minded animal. When it's done right, it's like getting married. This wasn't done right. You weren't educated about the wit by people that cared about you. A group of witted saw an opening and took advantage of it. The cat didn't choose you, that's bad enough, but I don't think the cat was even allowed to choose the woman. She stole it, as a kit, from the mother's den, and forced the bond. Then the woman died, but she kept on living in the cat." His eyes were wide and dark, staring up at me. He looked slightly aside from me, and I felt the wit working between them.
"I don't believe you. She says she can explain it all, that you're trying to confuse me."
The words spilled out of him hastily, as if he tried to hide behind them. I glanced over at the boy. Skepticism and confusion had closed his face. I took a breath and kept my temper. "Look, lad, I don't know all the details, but I can speculate. Perhaps she was dying. Maybe that's why she chose such a helpless creature and forced the bond. When a bond is uneven, as that one would have been, the stronger partner can control the weaker one. She could dominate the kit and move in and out, sharing the cat's body as she pleased. And when she died, instead of dying with her own body, she stepped over to the cat's." I stopped walking. I waited until Dutiful met my eyes. "You're next," I said quietly.
"You're mad! She loves me!"
I shook my head. I sense great ambition in her. She'll want a human body of her own again, not to be a cat, not to die when the cat's days are done. She'll have to find someone. It would have to be someone that was both witted and ignorant of the wit. Why not someone well-placed? Why not a prince? Conflicting expressions flickered over his face. Some part of him knew I spoke the truth, and it shamed him that he had been so deceived. He struggled to disbelieve me. I tried to temper my words so that he did not feel so foolish. "I think she selected you. You never had any choice at all, any more than the cat did. The woman cat is what you're bonded to, not the cat itself. And it wasn't done for love of you, any more than she loved the cat. No, somewhere, someone has a very careful plan, and you're just a tool for it. A tool for the piebalds."
"I don't believe you!"
His voice rose on the words.
"You're a liar!"
On those words, his voice cracked.
I saw his shoulders heave with the breath he took. I almost felt my skill command hold him back from attacking me. For a time I was carefully quiet. When I judged he had mastered himself, I spoke very quietly.
You've called me a bastard, a thief, and now a liar. A prince should be more mindful of what insults he flings unless he thinks that his title alone will protect him. So here's an insult for you, and a warning. Hide behind being a prince while calling me nasty names, and I'll call you a coward. The next time you insult me, your bloodlines won't stop my fist. I held his gaze until he looked aside from me, a cub cowed by a wolf. I lowered my voice, forcing him to listen carefully to catch my words. You're not stupid, Dutiful. You know I'm not a liar. She's dead, and you are being used. You don't want it to be true, but that's not the same as disbelieving me. You'll probably keep hoping and praying that something will happen to prove I'm wrong. It won't. I took a deep breath. About the only thing I can offer you right now is that none of this is really your fault. Someone should have protected you from this. Someone should have taught you about the old blood from the time you were small. There was no way to admit to either of us that that someone was me. The same person who had introduced him to the wit, and all it could be, through skill dreams when he was 4. We walked for a long time without speaking. I kept my eyes on my seaweed-festooned snag. Once I'd left the prince here, I could not predict how long I'd be gone. Could he care for himself? The treasures in the alcove made me uneasy. Such wealth belonged to someone, and that person might resent an intruder on his beach. Yet I could not take him back with me. He'd be a hindrance. A time alone, taking care of himself might do him good, I decided. And if I died trying to save the fool and Night Eyes, well, at least the piebalds would not have the prince. I set my teeth, trudged through the sand, and kept my grim thought to myself. We had nearly reached my snag when Dutiful spoke. His voice was very low.
You said my father taught you to skill. Did he teach you to...
Then he tripped on something. As he fell, the toe of his boot jerked a silver chain free of the sand that had covered it. He sat up, cursing, and then reached down to free his boot. As he dragged the loop chain clear of the sand, I gaped at it. It was an intricately woven thing, each thread of metal the thickness of a horsehair. He coiled it into his hand, a necklace length of chain that filled his palm. He gave a final tug to free the last loop, and a figurine popped from the sand. It was fastened to the chain as a dangling charm. It was the length of Dutiful's little finger. Bright colors had been enameled onto the metal. It was the image of a woman. We stared down at the proud face. The artist had given her black eyes and let the dark gold shine through for the tone of her skin. Her hair was painted black with a standing blue ornament crowning it. The draped garments bared one of her breasts. Bare feet of dark gold peeped from beneath the hem. She's beautiful, I said. He made no reply. The prince was engrossed by her. He turned the figurine over in his hand and traced the fall of hair down her back.
I don't know what this is made from. It weighs scarcely anything.
We both lifted our heads at the same instant. Perhaps it was our wit, warning us of the presence of another living being, but I do not think so. I had caught the scent of something indescribably foul in the air, yet even as I turned my head to seek the source of the stench, I almost became persuaded it was a sweet perfume. Almost. Some things one never forgets. The insidious tendrilling of mind touch is one of them. Terror spasmed through me, and I slammed up the skill walls around my mind in a reflex I thought I had forgotten. My reward was that I perceived the full foulness of its stench as I turned to confront a nightmare creature. It stood, as tall as I did, but that was only the portion of its body that reared upright. I could not decide if it reminded me of a reptile or a sea mammal. The flat, flounder eyes on the front of its face looked unnatural in their orientation. The brain bump of its skull seemed tumescently large. Its lower jaw dropped like a trapdoor as it stared at us. Its mouth could have engulfed a rabbit. A stiff, fishy tongue protruded from it briefly. As we stared, it jerked its tongue back in and closed its jaws with a snap. To my horror, The transfixed prince was smiling at the creature in an addled way. He swayed a step closer to it. I set my hand firmly to his shoulder and gripped hard. I set my thumb to his flesh and tried to invoke the earlier skill bond I had laid on him without breaching my own walls. "Come with me," I said quietly but firmly. I drew him back towards me, and if he did not actively obey, at least he did not resist me. The thing reared up even taller, sacks at the sides of its throat puffed as it lifted its flipper-like limbs. It suddenly spread finny hands that were large and wide, claws like bullfish spines stood out from the ends of the digits. Then it spoke, wheezing and belching the syllables. The shock of its distorted words felt like pebbles pelting against me.
"You did not come by the path. How came you?"
"We came by silence," I warned the prince, and gave him a rough shake. I was backing us away from the creature, but it hummocked its ungainly body over the sand towards us. Where had it come from? I glanced about wildly, fearing to see more of the creatures, but there was only the one. It made a sudden rush forwards, interposing its huge body between the tableland and us. I responded by retreating towards the water. It was where I wished to go anyway, the only possible escape that I could imagine. I prayed the tide would bear the skill pillar.
"You must leave it," the creature belched at us. "What the ocean washes up on the treasure beach must always remain here. Drop what you have found."
The prince opened his hand. The figurine fell, but the chain tangled on his lax fingers to dangle from his hand like a puppet.
"Drop it,"
the creature repeated more urgently. I decided the time for subtlety was past. I drew my sword awkwardly with my left hand, for I feared to let go of the prince. "Stay back," I warned. My feet were crunching over barnacles on the uneven rocks. I risked a glance behind me. I could see my squared-off black stones, but they barely stuck out above the water. The creature mistook my look.
"Your ship has left you here. There is nothing out there but ocean. Drop the treasure."
There was a hissing quality to its speech, most unnerving. It had no more lips than a lizard, but the teeth that the open mouth bared were multitudinous and sharp.
"The treasures of this beach are not for humans. What the sea brings here is meant to be lost to humankind. You are not worthy of it."
Seaweed squelched underfoot. The prince slipped and nearly went in. I kept my grip on his shoulder and dragged him back to his feet. 3 more steps and water lapped around my feet.
"You cannot swim far," the creature warned us. "The beach will have your bones."
Like a distant wind, I faintly felt the buffeting of fear that he directed at us. The prince's mind was unshielded, and he gave a sudden cry of wild terror. "I don't want to drown," he cried out. "Please, I don't want to drown." When he turned to me, the whites showed all round the edges of his eyes. I did not think him a coward. I knew only too well what it was like to have another mind impose panic on my unguarded thoughts. "Dutiful, you have to trust me. Trust me."
"I can't," he bellowed,
and I believed him. He was torn between us, my skill command for obedience warring with the insidious waves of fear the creature gushed at him. I tightened my grip and dragged him back with me as I retreated. The water was up to our knees. Every wave nudged against us in its passage. The wallowing creature did not hesitate to follow us. Doubtless it would be more at home in the sea. I risked another glance behind me. The skill pillar was close. I felt that vague confusion that the black memory stone always inflicted on me. It was strange to push myself toward disorientation in the hopes of salvation.
"Give me the treasure,"
the creature commanded, and virulent green droplets shimmered suddenly at the edge of its claws. It lifted them menacingly. In one motion, I sheathed my sword, threw my left arm around Dutiful, and flung us both backward into the water. As the creature dived towards us, I thought I saw a sudden flash of comprehension in those inhuman eyes. But it was too late. We fell full length into the cold, salt water, and my groping fingers sought and found the canted surface of the fallen pillar. I had no time to warn the prince, as it swallowed us. We stumbled out into an almost warm afternoon. The prince dropped nervelessly from my grip, to sprawl on a cobblestone street in the gush of salt water that had accompanied us. I drew a deep breath and looked around us. Wrong face! I had known this could happen, but had been too intent on escaping the thing on the beach to consider it. Each face of a skill pillar was carved with a rune that told where that surface would transport you. It was a wonderful system if one understood what the runes meant. With a jolt, I suddenly grasped how much I had risked. What if this pillar had been buried under stone, or shattered to pieces? I dared not think what might have become of us. Shaking, I stared at the foreign landscape. We stood in the windswept ruins of an abandoned Elderling city. It looked vaguely familiar, and I wondered if it were the same city that a similar pillar had once carried me to. But there was no time for exploration or speculation. All had gone wrong. My original plan had been to return alone through the pillar, to rush unhindered to the aid of my friends. But I could not leave Dutiful stunned and alone in this barren place any more than I could have left him on the hostile beach. I'd have to take him with me. "We have to go back," I told the prince. "We have to get back to Buck exactly as we came."
"I didn't like that at all."
His voice shook, and I knew instinctively that he was not speaking about the creature on the beach. Going through a pillar was a harrowing experience for an untrained mind. Regal had used the pillars recklessly in transporting his young skill users, little caring how many of them went mad from the process. I would not use my prince so recklessly, except that I had no other choice and no time. "I know," I said gently, "but we have to go now before the tide comes in any deeper." He stared at me without comprehension. I weighed him keeping his sanity against what the woman might know through him. Then I threw that concern aside. He had to understand, at least a little, or I'd emerge from the pillar with a drooling idiot. "We have to go back to the pillar on the beach. We know it has a face that will take us back to Buck. We'll have to discover which one." The boy made a small retching sound. He hunkered down on the cobblestones, pressing the heels of his hands to his temples.
"I don't think I can," he said faintly.
My heart smote me. "Waiting won't make it any better," I warned him. "I'll hold you together as best I can, but we have to go now, my prince."
"That thing might be waiting for us,"
he cried wildly, but I think he feared the passage more than any lurking creature. I stooped and put my arms around him, and although he struggled wildly, I dragged him back into the pillar with me. I had never used a pillar twice in such swift succession. I was unprepared for the sharp sensation of heat. As we emerged, I accidentally snuffed warm seawater up my nose. I stood up, holding Dutiful's head above water. The water around the pillar was seething with the heat from it, and the prince had been right. As I held his lax body in my arms and shook water from my face, I heard startled grunts from the beach. Not one, but four of the ungainly creatures had congregated there. At the sight of us, they charged, hunching across the sand and into the waves. No time to think or look or choose. The prince was limp and lolling. I clutched him to me and risked dropping my skill walls to try to hold his mind intact. As an incoming wave drove me to my knees, I slapped a hand to the steaming surface of the skill pillar. It dragged me in. The transit this time seemed unbearable. I swear I smelled a strange odor, oddly familiar and yet repulsive. "Dutiful, Dutiful, Prince, heir to the Farseer throne, son of Cutrican," I wrapped his tattering thoughts in my own and named him by every name I could think of. Then came a moment. He reached back to me.
"I know you."
That was all I sensed from him, but after that he held onto himself and to me. There was a queer passivity to our bond, and when at length we washed out onto green grass under a lowering sky, I wondered if the prince's mind had survived our escape from the treasure beach. Chapter 25. Ransom. "By these signs may you know one who has the potential for the skill. A child who comes of skilled parents. A child who wins often at games of physical skill and his opponents stumble, lose heart, or play poorly against him. A child who possesses memories not rightfully his. A child who dreams, and his dreams are detailed and contain knowledge beyond the child's own experience." Dun Needleson, Skillmaster to King Wielder. The barrow crouched on the hillside above us. It was raining, a misty but determined fall of water. The grass was deep and wet. I suddenly didn't have the strength to stand by myself, let alone support the prince. As one, we sank down until I knelt on the wet earth. I lowered his body to the sward. His eyes were open, but they stared blindly. Only the rasping of his breath showed me he was alive. We were back in Buck, but our situation was only marginally better than when we had last left here. We were both soaking wet. After a moment I became aware of an odd smell and realized that the pillar behind us was radiating warmth. The smell was the dampness forced out of the stone. I decided I would rather be cold than get too close to it. The figurine still dangled from the chain, tangled in the prince's fingers. I plucked it free, gathered up the chain, and put it inside my pouch. The prince made no response to any of this. "Dutiful?" I leaned closer and looked directly into his eyes. They didn't focus on me. The rain was falling on his face and his open eyes. I tapped him lightly on the cheek. "Prince Dutiful, do you hear me?" He blinked, slowly. It was not much of a response, but it was better than nothing. "You'll feel better in a little while. Just rest here for a time." I wasn't sure that was true, but I left him on the wet grass and climbed up on top of the barrow. I surveyed the surrounding lands, but saw no other humans. There wasn't much of anything to see, just rolling countryside and a few copses of trees. A flock of starlings wheeled in unison and settled again, squabbling over feed. Beyond the wild meadow there was a forest. There was nothing that looked like an immediate threat, but nothing that looked like food, drink, and shelter either. I was fairly certain that Dutiful would benefit from all three, and feared that without them he would sink further into unresponsiveness. But what I needed was even more basic. I wanted to know if my friends lived. I wanted beyond all rationality to reach out for my wolf. I longed to howl for him, to put my whole heart into that questing. I also knew it was the most foolish and reckless thing I could do. It would not only alert any witted ones nearby that I was here, it would also warn them that I was coming. I forced order onto my thoughts. I needed a refuge, and quickly. It seemed likely to me that the woman and the cat would be constantly questing for the prince. Even now they might be coming for him. The afternoon was already venturing towards evening. Dutiful had told me the piebalds would kill Nighteyes and the fool at sunset if I had not returned him. Somehow I must get the prince to a safe place before the woman could find us, then slip off on my own to discover where the piebalds held my friends and then free them. Before sunset. I racked my brain. The closest inn I knew of was the piebald prince. I doubted that Dutiful would get a fond welcome there. Yet Buckkeep was a long walk and a river fording away. I pondered but could think of no other refuge for him. In his present condition I could scarcely leave him here alone, and another trip through a pillar would be the end of Dutiful's mind, even if we emerged physically unscathed. I once more scanned the empty landscape. I reluctantly admitted that though I had choices, none of them were good. I abruptly decided that I would get us moving and try to think of something better along the way. I gave one final glance around before descending from the barrow. As I did so, my eye caught something, not a shape, but a movement beyond a cluster of trees. I crouched low and stared at it, trying to resolve what I had seen. In a few moments, the animal emerged. A horse. Black and tall. My Black. She stared towards me. Slowly I stood again. She was too far off to go chasing after her. She must have fled when the piebalds captured Nighteyes and the fool. I wondered what had become of Malta. I watched her for a moment longer, but she only stood and stared back at me. I turned my back on her and descended to the prince. He was no more coherent, but at least he had reacted to the chill rain by drawing into a ball and shivering. My apprehension for him was mixed with a guilty hope. Perhaps, in his present condition, he could not use his wit to let the piebalds know where we were. I set my hand to his shoulder and tried to make my voice gentle as I told him, "Let's get you up and walking. It will warm both of us." I don't know if my words made sense to him. He stared ahead blankly as I pulled him to his feet. Once up, he hunched over his crossed arms. The shivering did not abate. "Let's walk," I suggested, but he did not move until I put an arm around him and told him, "Walk with me now." Then he did, but it was a stumbling, staggering gait. At a snail's pace, we fled across the wet hillside. Very gradually, I became aware of the thud of hooves behind us. A glance back showed my Black following us. But when I stopped, she stopped also. When I let go of the prince, he sagged towards the earth, and the horse immediately became suspicious. I dragged the prince back to his feet. As we plodded on again, I could hear her uneven hoofbeats behind us again. I ignored my black until she had nearly caught up with us. Then I sat down and let Dutiful lean against me until her curiosity overcame her native wariness. I paid no attention to her until her breath was actually warm on the back of my neck. Even then I did not turn to her, but snaked a hand stealthily around to catch hold of the dangling reins. I think she was almost glad to be caught. I stood slowly and stroked her neck. Her coat was streaked with dried leather, and all her tack was damp. She had been grazing around her bit. Mud was crusted into one side of the saddle where she had tried to roll. I led her in a slow circle and confirmed what I feared. She was lamed. Something, perhaps the Withounds, had tried to run her down, but her fleetness had saved her. I was amazed that she had even stayed in the area, let alone come back to me when she saw me. Yet there would be no wild gallop to safety for any of us. The best we could do was a halting walk. I spent some little time trying to cajole the prince into standing and mounting the horse. It was only when I lost my patience and ordered him to get to his feet and get on the damned horse that he obeyed me. Dutiful did not respond to conversation, but he obeyed simple orders from me. Then I appreciated how deep that jolt of skill command had gone, and how firmly linked we remained. "Don't fight me," I had charged him, and some part of him interpreted that as, "Don't disobey me." Even with his cooperation, the mount was an awkward maneuver. As I heaved him up into the saddle, I feared he would topple off the other side. I didn't try to ride behind him. I doubted that my black would have tolerated it. Instead, I led her. The prince swayed with my black's hitching gait, but did not fall. He looked terrible. All the maturity had been stripped from his features, leaving him a sick child, his dark circled eyes wide, his mouth drooping. He looked as if he could die. The full impact of that possibility seized my heart in a cold grip. The prince dead. The end of the Farseer line and the shattering of the six duchies. A messy and painful death for Nettle. I could not let it happen that way. We entered a strip of open woods, startling a crow who rose cawing like a prophet of doom. It seemed an ill omen. I found myself talking to both prince and horse as we walked. I spoke in Burric's soothing cadence, using his reassuring words in a calming ritual remembered from my childhood. "Come along now. We're all going to be fine. There, there. The worst part is over. That's right, that's right." From that I progressed to humming, and again it was some tune that Burric had often hummed when he worked on injured horses or labouring mares. I think the familiar song calmed and settled me more than it did the horse or the prince. After a time I found myself talking aloud, as much to myself as to them. "Well, it looks as if Chade was right. You're going to skill whether you're taught to or not, and I'm afraid the same holds true for the wit. It's in your blood, lad, and unlike some, I don't think it can be beaten out of you. I don't think it should be, but it shouldn't be indulged the way you've indulged it either. It's not that different from the skill, really. A man has to set limits on his magic and on himself. Setting limits is part of being a man. So if we come out of this alive and intact, I'll teach you. I guess I'll teach myself as well. It's probably time for me to look into all those old skill scrolls and find out what's really in them. It scares me, though. In the last 2 years, the skill has come back on me like some sort of spreading ulcer. I don't know where it's taking me. And I fear what I don't know. That's the wolf in me, I guess. And Ida's breath, let him be safe right now, and my fool. Don't let them be in pain or dying simply because they knew me. If anything happens to either of them... It's strange, isn't it? How you don't know how big a part of you someone is until they're threatened. And then you think that you can't possibly go on if something happens to them, but the most frightening part is that actually you will go on. You'll have to go on. With them or without them. There's just no telling what you'll become. What will I be if Night Eyes is gone? Look at Small Ferret all those years ago. He went on and on, even though the only thing left in his little mind was to kill. What about my cat? His voice was soft. Relief washed through me that he had enough mind left to speak. At the same time, I hastily reviewed my thoughtless rambling and hoped he had not been paying too much attention. How do you feel, my prince?
I can't feel my cat.
A long silence followed. I finally said, "I can't feel my wolf either. Sometimes he needs to be separate from me. He was silent for so long that I feared he wasn't going to reply. Then he said,
"It doesn't feel like that. She's holding us apart. It feels as if I am being punished."
"Punished for what?" I kept my voice even and light, as if we discussed the weather.
"For not killing you. For not even trying to kill you. She can't understand why I don't. I can't explain why I don't, but it makes her angry with me."
There was a simplicity to his heart-spoken words, as if I conversed with the person behind all the manners and artifice of society. I sensed that our journey through the skill pillar had stripped away many layers of protection from him. He was vulnerable right now. He spoke and reasoned as soldiers do when they are in great pain, or when ill men try to speak through a fever. All his guards were dropped. It seemed as if he trusted me that he spoke of such things. I counseled myself not to hope for that, nor believe it. It was only the hardships he had been through that opened him to me like this, only that. I chose my words carefully.
"Is she with you now?"
"The woman." He nodded slowly.
"She is always with me now. She won't let me think alone."
He swallowed, and added hesitantly,
"She doesn't want me to talk to you, or listen. It's hard. She keeps pushing me.
Do you want to kill me?" Again, there was that pause before he spoke. It was as if he had to digest the words, not simply hear them. When he spoke, he didn't answer my question.
"You said she was dead. It made her very angry.
Because it is true.
She said she would explain later. She said that should be enough for me."
He was not looking at me, but when I gazed at him, he turned his whole head aside as if to be sure he would not see me.
"Then she was me. And she attacked you with the knife because I hadn't."
I couldn't tell if he was confused or ashamed.
"Wouldn't kill me?"
I suggested the word.
"Wouldn't,"
Dutiful admitted. I was amazed at how grateful I was for the small piece of knowledge. He had refused to kill me. I had thought only my skill command had stopped him.
"I wouldn't obey her. Sometimes I've disappointed her. But now she is truly angry with me."
"And they're punishing you for that disobedience, by leaving you alone." He gave his head one slow, grave shake.
"No, the cat does not care if I kill you or not. She would always be with me. But the woman, she is disappointed that I am not more loyal. So she separates us, me from the cat. The woman thinks that I should have been willing to show that I was worthy of her. How can they trust me if I refuse to prove my loyalty?"
"And you prove your loyalty by killing when you're told to kill."
He was silent for a long time. It gave me time to reflect. I had killed when I was told to kill. It had been part of my loyalty to my king, part of my bargain with my grandfather. He would educate me if I would be loyal to him. I discovered that I did not want Katrikan's son to be that loyal to anyone. He sighed.
"It was even more than that. She wants to make the decisions, all the decisions, every time, just as she told the cat what to hunt and when, and took her kills away. When she holds us close, it feels like love. But she can also hold back from us, and yet we are still held."
He could see that I did not understand. After a time, he added quietly, "I didn't like it when she used my body against you. Even if she hadn't been trying to kill you, I wouldn't have liked it. She pushed me to one side, just like..." He didn't want to admit it. I admire that he forced himself to it.
"Just like I felt her push the cat aside. When she didn't want to do cat things. When she was tired of grooming or didn't want to play. The cat doesn't like it either, but she doesn't know how to push back. I did. I pushed her back and she didn't like it. She didn't like that the cat felt me do it either. I think that's the biggest reason why I'm being punished, that I pushed her back."
He shook his head, baffled himself, and then asked,
"She's so real. How can you be sure she's dead?" I found I could not lie to him. I feel it. So does Night Eyes. He says the cat is riddled with her, as if she were parasites worming through her flesh. He felt sorry for the cat. Oh. The word was very small. I glanced back at him, and thought he looked more grey than pale now. His eyes went distant, and his thoughts travelled back. When I first got her, she loved for me to groom her. I kept her coat like silk, but after we left Buckkeep, sometimes the cat would want to be brushed, but the woman always said there was no time for that. The cat lost weight, and her fur was rough. I worried, but she always set my worry aside. She said it was just the season, that it would pass, and I believed her. Even though the cat wanted to be brushed. He looked stricken. I took no pleasure in telling you that. I suppose it doesn't matter now. For a long time, I led the horse in silence as I tried to puzzle out what his last words meant. Didn't matter that I was sorry, or didn't matter that she was dead. I believed so many things she told me, but I already knew that... They're coming now. The crow has fetched them. A sudden note of remorse came into his voice. His words were halting. They knew to watch the standing stone from all the legends of such stones, but she wouldn't let me tell you that, until now, when it doesn't matter. She finds it humorous now. He suddenly sat up straight in the saddle. Life came back into his face. Oh, cat! He breathed. Panic raced over me. I tried to set it aside. A quick scan of all horizons showed me no one, nothing. But he had said they were coming, and I was sure he had not lied. As long as he was with me and linked to the cat, I could not hope to hide from them. I could mount my black behind him and run her to death, but we still would not escape. We were too far from Buckkeep, and I had no other safe place, no other allies, and a crow keeping watch for them. I should have guessed. I dropped all restraint and reached out for my wolf. At least I would know he was alive. I touched him, but the wave of pain that immersed me was scalding. I had discovered the only thing worse than not knowing his fate. He was alive, and he suffered, and he still excluded me from his thoughts. I threw myself against his walls, but he had locked me out. In the fierceness of his defense, I wondered if he was even aware of me. It reminded me of a soldier clutching his sword beyond his ability to use it, or of wolves, jaws locked on each other's throats, dying together. In the space of that moment, in the tortured drawing of a breath, the piebalds appeared. They crested the hillside above us, and some emerged from the forest to our left. Behind us they came across the wild meadows, perhaps six of them. The big man on the warhorse rode with them. The crow sailed over us once, and this time his caw was mocking. I looked in vain for a gap in their circle that might permit escape. There was none. By the time I mounted my black and charged towards an opening, the others could effortlessly close it. Death rode towards me from every direction. I halted and drew my sword. The foolish thought came to me that I would rather have died with Verity's sword in my hand instead of this guardsman's blade. I waited. They did not race towards me. Rather, they came at a steady pace, like the slow closing of a noose. Perhaps it amused them to think of me standing there watching them come. It gave me far too much time to think. I sheathed my sword and took out my knife instead. "Get down," I said quietly. Dutiful looked down at me in vague confusion. "Get off the horse," I ordered him, and he obeyed, though I had to steady him before his second foot hit the ground. I wrapped an arm around his chest and carefully set the knife to his throat. "I'm sorry," I told him with great sincerity. Conviction was running through my veins like icy water, "but you are better dead than what the woman plans for you." He stood quite still in my grip. I didn't know if he didn't want to risk resistance or if he didn't care to resist. "How do you know what she intends for me?" he asked me evenly. "Because I know what I would do." That statement wasn't quite true, I told myself. I'd never take over another person's body and mind simply for the sake of extending my life. I was too noble for that. So noble that I'd kill my prince before I'd let him be used that way. So noble that I'd kill him, knowing my daughter must then die as well. I didn't want to look too closely at that reasoning. So I held my knife to the throat of Verity's only heir and watched the piebalds come. I waited until they were within shouting distance, and then I raised my voice. "Come any closer, and I'll kill him." The big man on the warhorse was their leader.
He lifted his hands to stop the advance of the others, but then he himself rode slowly forwards, as if to test my resolve. I watched him come, and my grip on the prince tightened.